reading a little bit about, you know, you and your background and things, so it was 1968, I think, your parents left Cuba,
right,
went to Spain. You were born in Spain. Then they moved as a family to the United States. And it has set up this great line that you use often, that you were made in Cuba, assembled in Spain, and imported to the United States. There's so much in that statement, so much packed into that. Similar themes run through all of your writing, these questions of who am I, where am I from, what and where is home? How has that played out over your career?
I like that pithy saying. It's very sort of poetic and compressed, but it does say a lot. And even more, you know, the idea, I always look back at it as this sort of interesting foreshadowing of the things that would come to obsess me in my life and in my writing. You know, being 45 days old and belonging to three countries and having lived in two world-class cities and then moving to Miami at age four. So the questions of home and belonging is something that was always with me. Of course, you grow up and you grow up with a lot of things happening around you that you're not realizing how much they're affecting you consciously or subconsciously. And when I started writing, of course, this was the theme that just completely popped up, this idea of where, which is really a very universal question. You know, where am I from? Where do I belong? Who am I in this world? And so I just, I sort of realized that my, in terms of my story, that question is, of course, very exaggerated and sort of very prevalent and relevant, but it's really something we all ask ourselves many times throughout our lives. That idea of, you know, of how do we connect with place? What is community? What is family? What is home? All that big word home calls into mind, you know, from cultural loyalties to cultural identity to even sexuality, really. Mm-hmm. All that idea of home, of that space where we belong, where we come from, or, and how it changes throughout time.
At some point, you had made a comment about how there was that imaginary Cuba and that imaginary America, and in the end, neither one of them really came true.
Right. And I mean, both, I explored them and came to a better understanding of the reality of those two places, but certainly it wasn't sort of the mythic, overly romanticized or misinformed versions of
the
Cuba.
Brady Bunch version. Or
the Brady Bunch version, which, right. I mean, which I still live with, and I, you know, myths don't go away just because you discover they're not true. They sort of still live in your psyche, so to speak. But yeah, that was the journey after going to Cuba that I actually moved to what I considered the real United States, which is New England, having grown up in Miami, which sort of it's its own sort of kind of a cultural purgatory. It's like this place that's in between Cuba and the real United States.
So people write for all sorts of different reasons, or do art of any form for different types of reasons. And you've talked about turning to writing, I think it was in your 20s, as a way to try to process some of the things and some of the struggles that you had growing up around issues of identity and home and things like that. Looking back now at this point, has your writing brought you any closer to an answer, or maybe answers, I guess?
Yes and no. I mean, I think art takes up these kinds of complex questions because there's no final answer. And again, it's something that arts deal with is those kinds of conditions of being human that are constantly changing or evolving in our lifetime or in our history, and there is no final answer, but certainly exploration and sort of coming to deeper understandings of things and perhaps asking new questions. They say that every writer is in some way writing the same poem or the same novel all their lives, and this is this idea that we all revolve, that our entire body of work sort of revolves around a central obsession. For me, that is obviously home, and though I've learned different things along the way, it's like research. One question answered asks, then 20 new questions come into mind. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this great irony to art. I mean, I think all art, not just writing. There's this great irony that it's about finding, it's about this sort of really selfish, arrogant quest for the self and understanding the self and one story and understanding all the dimensions of me. But the artist understands that really the object of that is to transcend the very story that you are trying to expound, that in some ways you're trying to reach for the common emotional human denominators that unite us all. And so the setting had changes, you know, West Side Story is just Romeo and Juliet retold. Mm-hmm. So the setting changes because it's your story. You have to change the set and change the characters. But the basic human emotions are all universal. So on the surface, my story is about, you know, this kid, this Cuban-American kid, this pudgy Cuban American kid trying to figure out his cultural identity, his sexual identity, his artistic identity, especially in the last memoir. And yet, at the same time, you know, we all have a version of that in our heads. We all have had to grow up. We've all have felt like the odd man out. You know, we've all had to. We've all had to deal with feeling different. We've all had to deal with claiming or reclaiming who we are in the world through our parents and grandparents. So I've always written with that idea that my job as an author is always to bridge understanding, to get us all to a space of understanding our common shared humanity. Mm-hmm. And how I do that and how I think art does that wonderfully is to get us to feel, which is in a different way than more sort of analytical ways to get to the same space. When you feeling, and so much of our life now is anti-feeling. You know, we're rushed, we're like this, we don't have time to think or pause or feel anything, but to just, and poetry especially in that compact space in 5 minutes gets you to stop. And so for me also, the success of a poem or any art really is to become a mirror that shines back on the listener or the reader or the viewer and says, and actually we're both standing in front of the poem or the painting, and that becomes a mirror, and the life of the artist and the consumer sort of get blurred, and it's in that weird interaction of where there isn't two separate lives but one life in the mirror that I think is the magic of art and what I strive for.
You know, in your work and in your career, labels. There's lots of labels that come up around you. Cuban, American, immigrant, gay, engineer, poet, writer. For someone who thinks and writes a lot about these things, about identity and home and where you come from, what role do labels play sort of in what you do and how you present yourself?
Right. Yeah. I just love my labels, but I want to own my labels. I don't want to be labeled, but I want to label myself. And so I have no problem with calling myself all those things. Now, if you call me something that I don't feel I can own, then we have a problem. But to me, the label is sort of, right now in America, perhaps, it's still a necessary thing as a way of saying, I'm talking about these things that need to be talked about. I'm representing these things happily so. But I try to, you know, there's a fine line between label and stereotype. So label is a kind of a useful, practical thing. But once you start sort of tipping towards stereotyping me, then I step in and say, you know, in some ways my job is to actually validate that stereotype sometimes, but add to it, you know, because stereotypes do have their roots in Cubans can't dance, you know what I'm saying? I mean, for the most part, we can dance, you know what I'm saying? There's nothing wrong with that. You know, how to add dimension to that. Again, it's the art of storytelling. And I don't, you know, if people come to me honestly with an honest openness and saying, I think this, tell me what Cuba's about or what is your journey. I'm very generous with people if it's coming from a genuine place of inquiry, and I take the moment to share and again bridge that connection in a way.
Among the labels, and I'll turn a corner here a little bit here, but among those labels are youngest, first Latino, first immigrant, and first openly gay poet to serve as inaugural poet of the United States.
Right.
So you deliver the poem for President Obama's second inauguration, and interestingly, so you get a phone call from the White House. And you said that you started writing the poem, although I guess there were three of them, in your head almost the moment you got the call from the White House.
Right.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, there's immediately images started coming to mind. I mean, besides the fact that I only had 3 weeks to write three poems, it's kind of had to start working. I was driving home to Maine, but
so you got the phone call in the car
as
you're driving home to Maine. Nice.
A little thing that's sort of not written down anywhere. Again, given my obsession and this whole idea of home, and in a way, I've been directly or indirectly questioning what does it mean to be an American or what is America all the while in my writing. And so for about 3 seconds, I was a little cocky in a way. I was like a little overconfident because that.
I got this. No problem.
Don't worry, President Obama. I got this. You know,
you called the right guy.
I got it. You've reached the right number. But obviously, that lasted like 3 seconds when you realized the daunting task ahead of you, because it in a way, is a very different poem, because it was the first poem that I would write that was occasional and that would be heard before it would ever be read. So in so many ways, it was different, and it was a poem that had to be inclusive while yet sort of possessing that sort of personal story, not arrogance, but of selfishness, of passion, that had to come through in the poem as well. And I had never quite had to balance that kind of a greater sort of inclusivity while still telling my story, and a story that transcends itself and bridges. I mean, I think part of what in writing any part of the challenge in this particular element, I think of any poem that I write, is not so much the actual writing of it, and it's not so much the actual craft of it, but it's really, again, that finding that emotional center, that reason for being, from which the poems sort of, everything from the poem sort of germinates. And that's really a soul-searching, emotional, psychological question. And for me, the crux of that was, am I American? I had sort of found a sort of to be okay in this peaceful sense of not being either or. And suddenly I'm supposed to write a poem for America and about being American. And I didn't know if I had the emotional authority or permission to do so.
Hmm.
And that was the question I had to answer. Richard, are you an American? Do you still have to be Peter Brady? Do you love this country? Is this where you'll be buried, as my mom says? Hmm. That's your country. And it was a few days of going around that. It was actually the tragedy of Sandy Hook. And that's why that moment is referenced in the poem, that opened up that emotional door to really connect and understand that, yes, this is my country. These are my people. And at moments like that, of course, all racial and ethnic and socioeconomic boundaries just disappeared. And then from that moment forward, I think I had the emotional door open, and I gave myself permission emotionally to engage with the poem.
And walk through that door. It's interesting that there are so many moments that kind of define who we are and the experience that we have and propel us forward. And you've written about many of them. You talked about the moment where you gave yourself the permission, where you asked the questions that you just talked about there. You've also talked about a moment, you're sitting there, you're along the National Mall, it's Inauguration Day, the president is there, you know, you're about to be introduced to present this poem to the nation and the world. You turn to your mother, who's next to you, and you say, well, I guess now we are finally Americanos.
Right.
Why that moment? What changed in that moment, then?
Well, you know, a lot of it was that, you know, by then it had been almost five, you know, three weeks to write the poem, 2 weeks to get ready and all the rest and get to Washington. So a lot of it, you were just going with the logistics and the, you know, just getting the job done, you know, like, and sitting there was the first time where everything came to bear, where I finally had this moment to go, you know, take a breath and listening to that whole ceremony, listening to the president's speech. I was overwhelmed by the sense of it's this palpable, almost sacred moment that happens in America. And I had never been to an inauguration before. And granted, there were great seats that I had, but the idea is there was something that connected, and there was another sort of emotional connection, which was, in some ways, like many of us, I've become jaded. I had become perhaps a little, had given up a little bit on the sort of the American ideal and this idea. You know, we can tend to be overly critical of everything, and overly analytical about everything. And in some ways, that sitting there, I felt like this little grade school kid again. And it really is palpable. You feel the sense that those founding ideals of this country are still intact. They're like this little protected little golden box somewhere hidden. And it's actually, you can feel that. And you realize that at some moment in the ceremony, this is not about me. It's not about, you just feel something, part of something so much greater. This isn't even about the president. It isn't even about Beyonce. There's something sacred and ritualistic about it that says something very powerful. And at that moment, I just felt this other kind of connection. And of course, I had been searching for home and home and home and home and home. And in some ways, the greatest gift of the inauguration was that moment where in some ways I realized I was home all along. And suddenly, it's like the sense of arrival and of being embraced. And of course, embracing America back, which is what the poem was trying to do as well.
Yeah, and it was a remarkable moment. I mean, standing up there.
And, in many more ways than one. Most people think it's just because of the, you know, 40 million people or whatnot. And of course, that's a large part of it. But it was very intimate and personal. What happened was in a complete surprise in some ways.
So you've been, let's see, you've inaugural poet, fifth inaugural poet of the United States. You've got two new books out, or recent books out at the moment, working on more. A children's book of the poem is coming, I understand.
Right.
What's next? What do you do for an encore after all this?
I want to, I have to get back to poetry because I, the latest book, The Prince of Los Cucuyos, a memoir, I'm very proud of it, but it's also, I realized through the process that that poetry lays the emotional outline or groundwork for that can become prose. So I think I need to go back to poetry to figure out the next sort of projects or what's surrounding about them. So I'm really craving to go back to poetry, and that's fine, and to explore questions, again, this question of home, but perhaps in a little bit more, now that I've had all these experiences, a little bit more just outside of, not feeling that I have to stick to the biographical sphere as much, but rather the exploration of question perhaps in the way that the inaugural poem did it, on a sort of with these broader strokes and thinking about what home is and what the question of America, which is the same question that Whitman was asking, we're still asking today, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm eager to explore that same obsession but another dimension of it. And then beyond that, there's talk of optioning the memoir for a TV series, which if you read the book, you'll understand.
I thought you were going to say a movie, but no, a TV series.
No, which makes me even happier because as you can, if you read the book, I'm like obsessed with sitcoms, and it's actually how I contextualized America.
Well, there's great images in there. I'm a great family Thanksgiving dinners and things like this.
Yeah,
you try to navigate all these terrains.
And, and you know, I still watched all the great sitcoms and the Brady Bunch and all stuff. So it's something that's really informed and impassioned my life in a really interesting, both just sort of plain indulgent way, but also in a very intellectual way. And I think TV has incredible power, and it actually holds more power now than I think even movies in a way, because movies are so come and go so fast now.
That's true.
But, you know, these series have started to become like, you know, it's like soap opera. Everybody's talking about this or that, and having conversations beyond what the show is presenting is more than just mere entertainment. And this wonderful way that television is also turning to very ethnically specific shows, that is really sort of a wonderful turn. So I'm eager to see where that goes. There's nothing final. It's just sort of out there. So that'll keep me busy. And I think there might be a follow-up memoir about Cuba. This memoir ends when I'm 17, but about my actual journeys, my first journey to Cuba, and some of what that all meant, especially now that it seems so relevant to sort of demystify and redirect or correct this overly romanticized picture of Cuba that has come back online, or on, maybe it was always online, but really hyper now, this idea of the still that's about to cigar smoking rumba shirt thing. And how can we, you know, think about Cuba not as a franchise but as a real country, and about the whole Cuban American diaspora as something much more complex than, you know, than just this idea of Castro and Cuba and now it's open and everything's fine. There's a lot of work and a lot of dimensioning to happen in all this.
That has to go forward. All right, well, Richard Blanco served as the fifth inaugural poet of the United States. His books include The Prince of, I'm going to get this right, Los Cucuyos.
Perfect.
And for all of us, one today, an inaugural poet's journey. Richard Blanco, it's nice to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.